This is disc number 17.
After Zed had vanished with Kara through the junipers and into the fog, Nikki crouched down beside Richard and laid a hand on his back between his slumped shoulders.
It will be all right, Richard.
I wonder if anything will ever be all right again.
It may not seem that way now, but it will.
Zed will get over his anger of the moment and come to understand that you were doing your best to act responsibly. I know that he loves you and that he didn't intend what he said to hurt you so.
Richard nodded without looking up as he knelt in the mud beside the open coffin, holding the corpse of the long-dead Kaylin Amnell. The woman he had imagined had been his love.
Nikki?
He finally asked so softly she could hardly hear him over the soft sound of the gentle rain.
Will you do something for me?
Anything, Richard.
One last time, be death's mistress for me.
She rubbed his back and then stood, tears mixing with the rain on her face.
By sheer force of will, past the sob, struggling to escape, she made her voice steady.
I can't, Richard. You've taught me to embrace life.
Chapter 49. The heavy paneled door opened partway. Rika stuck her head into the silent room.
Someone is coming.
Nikki pushed her padded chair away from the polished library table.
Coming?
Up toward the keep.
Do you know who?
She asked as she stood.
Rika shook her head.
Zed just told me that the shields warned him that someone was on their way up the road. He thought you ought to know.
I tell you, all the magic flying around in this place makes my skin crawl.
I'll go find Richard.
Rika nodded before vanishing out of the doorway. Nikki quickly returned the book she had been studying to its slot in the vast expanse of mahogany shelves that filled the quiet library. The book was a tedious report on activities in the keep during the Great War. Nikki found it rather strange, reading about all the people who had once lived in the wizard's keep thousands of years ago. It seemed a disconnected history, except when she intermittently reminded herself that they were talking about the very place where she was. She considered how, in contrast, the Palace of the Prophets had been so full of life and activity for so long. Nikki couldn't imagine the Palace of the Prophets empty of all but a few souls, and the keep was vastly larger. Of course, now the palace was no more, while the keep still stood. Nikki hadn't really been interested in the book she'd been reading. It was boring, but she didn't really care. It was merely something to occupy her time. She couldn't force herself to concentrate on anything that would be absorbing or that would require her to put any great effort into thinking. She was too distracted. The new moon at the time they had dug up the grave of the Mother Confessor had grown to a full moon, and was now approaching its last quarter again, and yet nothing much had changed. A few days after digging up the body, Zed had told Richard that he loved him and was sorry to have been so hard on him, when maybe he should have found out a little more before saying the things he'd said. Zed promised that they would figure out a way to get Richard's sword back, and everything would be all right. It might have been sincere, and it might have been true, but for Richard, the hurt of such a personal failure was hard to put back into the bottle. He had not just disappointed and angered his grandfather. He had failed to prove his dream was in fact the truth. He had put everything he had into the effort. He had been certain, and in the end, he had only proved himself wrong. Richard had only nodded to Zed's words. Nikki didn't think it mattered much to him either way if Zed had softened his viewpoint. He had reached the end of his ideas, his hopes, and his efforts. Nothing had helped him. After that night, the life had gone out of him. Zed had interrogated Kara and Nikki for hours that first night. Nikki had been stunned to hear from Kara what Shota had said about the beast becoming a blood beast, because Nikki had inadvertently given it the measure of Richard's ancestral blood. She was horrified to learn that she had been responsible for intensifying the danger to Richard. While astonished at how Nikki had accomplished saving Richard's life, Zed had quietly assured her that had she not acted, Richard would most certainly have died right then and there.
He said that she had given Richard a chance at life, and now they could work to solve the problem of the beast Jigang's sisters had created. As well as Richard's strange delusions and the matter of recovering his sword. From what Shota had revealed about the beast, on top of what Nikki already knew, it didn't look to Nikki that they had much of a chance of success. She had no idea at all of how to even begin to destroy such a beast spawned of dark powers. She had also been embarrassed to hear Kara telling about how Shota had revealed to Richard Kara's plan for Nikki to interest Richard romantically. Zed, thankfully, had withheld any comments on that part of Kara's story. That, among other things, had left Nikki feeling rather hopeless and helpless. The Imperial Order was rampaging unchecked through the New World. The beast was stalking Richard, and he was not himself, to say the least. In some ways, it reminded her of her dead attitude toward life back before Richard. She had been taught that she had been born lucky in every way. And because she had ability, it was her duty to devote herself to those in need. No matter how hard she worked, the need always outpaced her ability to meet them, leaving her perpetually in debt to the ever-worsening lives of others, while her own life was not her own. Her feeling about what was happening now with the Beast and Richard's delusions were different in almost every way, except they were the same in that they gave her that familiar feeling of hollow hopelessness. Richard had spent the long days since opening the grave and discovering the truth, off by himself, with the exception that Kara, after answering all of Zed's tedious questions about everything she knew about what had happened with Shota, refused to leave Richard's side for any reason. Since Richard was in no mood to talk to anyone, Kara had become his silent shadow. It was strange seeing the two of them together, totally at ease with each other even at such a time. It didn't seem to Nikki like the two of them even needed to speak. Yet they managed with a look, a slight shrug, or a nothing at all, to all the time understand each other. Nikki felt like an unwelcome outsider to his misery, and so she left him be. She remained as close as she could so that she would be at hand should the beast attack, but she stayed out of his sight and left him to his solitude. The first 4 or 5 days after arriving at the keep, Richard had spent in the Confessor's Palace, wandering the magnificent rooms and vast network of halls. Nikki stayed in a guest room in the palace, out of sight, while Richard roamed aimlessly about the empty place. After that, he'd gone out and wandered the city of Adendrill for a half dozen days, walking the streets and alleys as if reliving the life that had once been there. It was a lot more difficult for Nikki to stay close to him when he walked all day long through the city. After that, he had spent yet more days wandering the forests of the mountains around Adendrill, sometimes not even returning at night. Richard was at home in the woods, so Nikki had decided not to follow him, knowing how difficult it would have been for her to keep Richard from knowing she was there. She was comforted somewhat by her connection of magic with him, that allowed her always to be aware of what direction he was and roughly how far away. When he didn't come back at night, though, Nikki paced, unable to sleep. Zed finally asked Richard to please remain at the keep so that in case the beast were to attack, Zed and Nikki could help stop it. Richard had done as he'd been asked without comment or objection. He'd spent recent days, instead of wandering the palace or the city or the woods, wandering the outer ramparts of the keep, staring off into the distance. Nikki desperately wanted to do something to help him, but Zed had insisted that there was nothing to do but wait and see if time would begin to bring him around to the reality that he had only dreamed up his relationship with Kaelin during the time he had been unconscious. In this, Nikki didn't really think time would solve anything. She'd been with Richard long enough to realize that this was something bigger. She believed that he needed some kind of help, but she didn't know what that help could possibly be. Nikki hurried down the wood-paneled hall outside the library, her feet swishing across thick carpets. She rushed up through the maze of stairwells and passageways, using her sense of her gifted connection with Richard to guide her, letting that thread of magic take her where it may, rather than trying to deliberately remember and find her way through the keep. As she made her way ever closer to him, she reminisced about the kiss she had given him to link them, so that she could find him. She felt rather guilty about that kiss, even if it had been achingly wonderful to do it. It had been far more than she needed to do. She could have simply touched a finger to the back of his hand or a shoulder and established a link without him feeling a thing. But Kara had just been telling her how maybe she needed to make him more aware of her, and filled her mind with heady thoughts of the possibilities. That kiss would certainly have planted her firmly in his thoughts. In a way, though, she felt it was too forward, considering his mental state. He was in love with someone else, even if it was a dream, and Nikki hadn't respected that. She regretted, in a way, giving him that kiss. In another way, she wished she had planted it on his lips instead of his cheek, as Shota had done. It burned her to hear Kara telling them how Shota had kissed him and tried to get him to stay with her. Nikki knew how the witch woman felt, but that didn't make her any happier about it. Nikki would give anything to be able to hold him now, to comfort him, tell him that it would be all right for no other reason than simply to try to make him feel just a little better, to reassure him that there were others around who cared about him. But she knew that this was not the time or circumstances for such things. At the same time, she knew that this could not continue. He simply could not go on like this. His life could not stay in this static state, drifting without his conscious direction. He had to come to his senses. Nikki hurried onward, quickening her pace, down the endless maze of halls and through empty but grand rooms, suddenly feeling, for some reason, the urgent need to be with him. Richard stood at the brink of the wall, an arm resting on a massive Merlin to each side, as he stared out through the crenellation. It felt like standing at the edge of the world. Gray patches of shade drifted slowly over the hills and fields far below, as their mothering cloud shepherded them along. He seemed to have lost all track of time. Every day had become the same monotonous, pointless, empty existence. He didn't even know how long he had been standing at the gap in the wall, staring out at nothing in particular. With Kaelin dead and gone, nothing mattered anymore. He had trouble imagining why it ever had. He couldn't even imagine for sure now that she had ever been real. But whether or not she had been, it was over. Kara was close. She was always close. In a way, it was comforting knowing that he could depend on her for anything. In some ways, though, it was wearing to have her always there, so that he was never able to have a moment's privacy. He wondered if she believed she was close enough to snatch him if he jumped. He knew that she wasn't. He gazed at the tiny little roofs crowded together in the city of Adendril far below. In a way, he felt an affinity for the city. It was empty. He was empty. Life was gone from both of them. Since digging up the grave, he couldn't bring himself to call it Kaelin's grave, even in his own mind, much less out loud. He didn't think there was anything worth being alive for anymore. If a person could die by sheer will alone, he would already be dead, but death, when invited, had suddenly grown shy. The days dragged endlessly on. He had been so stunned by that grave that it seemed his mind had been scrambled on the spot. It felt like he had lost his ability to think. Nothing he knew made sense to him. The things he'd thought were true somehow no longer were. His whole world had been turned upside down. How could he function if he couldn't tell what was real and what wasn't? He didn't know what else to do. For the first time in his life, he was baffled and defeated by the way things were. He always seemed to have a variety of options that he knew he could try. Now he didn't. He had tried everything he could think of. None of it worked. He was at the end of his rope, and there was none left. And all the time in his mind, he kept seeing her body in the coffin. He saw, he heard, he felt, but he could not think, could not put anything together in a meaningful way. It was a walking, living imitation of death, a poor one, he believed. What good was living if it felt this way? He longed only for that dark, forever embrace of nothingness to take him. He was so far beyond hurt, beyond sadness, beyond grief, that there was only an unthinking, empty, blind, confused agony that never for a second would release him enough to get a breath. He wanted desperately to escape the truth, to refuse to allow it to be real, but he couldn't, and it was suffocating him. The wind coming up the mountain ruffled his hair as he stared out over a precipitous drop of thousands of feet. What good was he to anyone? He'd let Zed down. He'd given Shota the sword of truth for nothing of value. Nikki thought he was out of his mind, that he was delusional. Not even Kara believed him, really believed him. He was the only one who believed him, and he had proved himself wrong by digging up her grave. He guessed he must be crazy, that Nikki had to be right. Everyone was right. He could only be imagining things. He could see it in all their eyes, the way they looked at him, that he had lost his mind. Richard gazed down the sheer drop of the dark stones of the massive outer keep wall. They fell away below him for thousands of feet toward the rock and forest below. Gusts of wind coming up the face of the wall buffeted him. It was a dizzying sight, a dizzying drop. What good was he to anyone, most of all to himself? He stole a sidelong glance at Kara. She was close, but not nearly close enough. Richard didn't see any reason to continue the agony. He didn't have his mind, and his mind was life. He didn't have Kaelin. She was his life. From what everyone told him, from what he saw in the coffin that terrible night, he never had her. It was all just a mad delusion, a wish, a whim. He glanced down again at the forever drop off the towering wall on the side of the keep, at the rocks and trees spread out below. It was a very, very long way down. He recalled people saying that just before you died, you relived your life. If he were to relive his life, he would relive every precious moment he'd had with Kaelin, or thought he'd had. It was a long way down. A long time to relive such wonderful, romantic, loving times. A long time to relive every precious moment he'd spent with her. Chapter 50. Nikki opened an iron-strapped oak door to bright daylight. Puffy white clouds skimmed by just overhead in a sparkling azure sky that on any other day would have lifted her spirits. A fresh breeze carried her hair across her face. She pulled it away as she gazed down the narrow bridge to a rampart in the distance. Richard stood beyond the end of the bridge, at the far wall of the rampart, in the gap of the crenellation, looking down the mountain. Kara, nearby, turned when she heard the door. Nikki hurried across the bridge above courtyards far below. She could see several stone benches down among the rose garden at the bottom of a tower and juncture of several walls. When she finally reached Richard's side, he glanced over, giving her a brief, small smile. It warmed her to see it, even though she knew the smile was little more than a polite formality. Rika came and told me that someone approaches the keep. I thought I should come and get you. Kara, standing only 3 strides away, stepped a little closer. Does Rika know who it is? Nikki shook her head. I'm afraid not, and I'm more than a little worried. Without moving or taking his eyes from the distant countryside, Richard said, It's Anne and Nathan. Nikki's eyebrows lifted in surprise. She looked over the edge. Richard pointed them out far below on the road that wound its way up the mountain toward the keep. There are 3 riders, Nikki said. Richard nodded. It looks like it might be Tom with them. Nikki leaned out a little farther past Richard and peered down the face of the stone wall. It was a frightening drop. The feeling came over her that she didn't at all like where he was standing. With a hand on his shoulder to steady herself, Nikki looked out again at the 3 horses plodding their way up the sunlit road. They briefly disappeared under trees, only to emerge a moment later as they continued steadily up toward the keep. A gust of wind suddenly threatened to unbalance her from her footing in the slot in the immense stone wall. Before it could, Richard's arm around her waist steadied her. She instinctively drew back from the edge. Once she was on safe footing, his protective arm released her.
"You can tell for sure from here that it's Anne and Nathan?" she asked.
"Yes." Nikki wasn't especially enthusiastic about seeing the prelate again. As a sister of the light and having lived at the Palace of the Prophets for most of her life, Nikki had had just about all she wanted of the sisters and their leader. In many ways, the prelate was a mother figure to her, as she had been to all the sisters. Someone who was there to remind them whenever they were a disappointment and lecture them when they had to redouble their efforts to help others in need. When she had been young, should self-interest ever rear its ugly head, Nikki's mother had always been at the ready to bitterly slap it down. Later in Nikki's life, the prelate served in that same capacity, if with a kindly smile. Slap or smile, it was the same thing, servitude, even if under a nicer name. Nathan Rawl was another matter. She didn't really know the prophet. There were sisters, and novices especially, who trembled at the mere mention of his name. From what everyone always said, though, he was not simply dangerous but possibly deranged, which, if true, had disturbing implications for Richard's present condition. The prophet had been held in secure quarters almost all his entire life, the sisters seeing not only to his needs but seeing to it that he never escaped. People in the city of Tanimura, where the palace had been, were both titillated and terrified of the prophet, of what he might tell them of the future. Whispers were, among the people of the city, that he was most surely wicked, since he could tell them things about their future. Ability tended to arouse the ire of a great many people, especially when that ability was not one that could easily be made to serve their wants. Nikki wasn't much worried about what people said about Nathan, though. She'd had experience with truly dangerous people, with Jigang only the most recent to grace the top of her list of the wicked.
"We'd better get down there," Nikki told Richard and Kara.
Richard stared out over the countryside. "You go on if you want."
He sounded like he couldn't have cared less that someone was coming or who it was. It was obvious that his mind was elsewhere, and he only wanted her to go away.
Nikki pulled a flag of hair back off her face.
"Don't you think you ought to see what they want? After all, they must have traveled a long way to get here. I'm sure they didn't come bringing milk and cakes."
Richard shrugged one shoulder, showing no reaction to her attempt at humor.
"Zed can see to it."
Nikki so missed the light in Richard's eyes. She was at the end of her endurance of the situation. She glanced over at the moored Sith and spoke in quiet but unmistakable command.
"Kara, why don't you go for a little walk, please?"
Kara, surprised by such an unusual but clear directive coming from Nikki, took in Richard standing at the opening in the wall, staring off into the distance, and then gave Nikki a conspiratorial nod. Nikki watched Kara walk off down the rampart before finally addressing Richard again, but this time in a boldly forthright manner.
"Richard, you have to stop this."
As he gazed out at the vast scene below, he didn't answer. Nikki knew that she couldn't allow herself to fail in what she had to say, what she had to accomplish. She would do almost anything to have Richard care about having her in his life, but she didn't want to win him this way. She didn't want to be second best to a corpse or a substitute to a dream he couldn't make real. If she was ever to have him, she would only have him because he chose her, not because he was left with nothing else. There had been a time when she would have accepted on those grounds, but no more. She respected herself more than that now, and all because of Richard. But even more than that, this was not the Richard she knew and loved. Even if she could never have him, she still wouldn't allow him to sink to the terribly dark place he was in. If she could give him a needed push back up toward life, and that was all she could ever do for him, then she would. Even if she had to play the role of antagonist to get him out of his downward spiral, and she could be no more than that to him, then she would. She laid a hand on the stone Merlin, making herself impossible to avoid, and took an even more confrontational tone. "Aren't you going to fight for what you believe in?" They can fight if they want.
His voice didn't sound despondent. It sounded dead.
That's not what I mean.
Nicky grasped his arm and gently but firmly pulled him around, turning him from the drop-off, forcing him to face her.
Aren't you going to fight for yourself?
He met her gaze but didn't answer.
This is because Zed told you that he was disappointed in you.
I think the grave I dug up might have had a bit to do with it.
You may think so, but I don't. Why should it? You have been devastated and sent reeling by things before. I captured you and took you away to the old world, and what did you do? You stood up for yourself and acted like yourself and on your beliefs, within the limits of what I would allow you to do. By being who you are, you exerted your love of life, and that changed my life. You showed me the truth of the joy of life and all it means. This time, you woke up from nearly dying, to me and Kara and everyone else not believing in your memory of Kalen. But that never stopped you. You kept arguing your convictions despite everything we said.
What was in that coffin is different, and I'd say a little more than a simple argument when someone doesn't believe you.
Is it? I don't think so. It was a skeleton, so what?
So what? Annoyance crept into his features. Are you out of your mind? What do you mean, so what?
Far be it from me to argue your case when I don't believe in it, but I don't seek to win you to what I believe is the truth by default. I would want to win you over with the true facts, not with this flimsy evidence.
What do you mean?
Well, was it Kalen's face you saw to prove to you that it really was her? No, it couldn't be. There was no face left. Just a skull, no face, no eyes, no features. The skeleton was wearing the dress of the Mother Confessor. So what? I was in the Confessor's palace and there were other dresses there like that.
So, was a name stitched on a gold ribbon enough to prove it to you? Enough to bring you to an end of your search, your beliefs? After all the things that Kara and I have said to you, have argued to you, have reasoned to you, you all of a sudden feel that this flimsy evidence proves you delusional?
A skeleton in a coffin, holding a ribbon with her name stitched on it, is enough to suddenly convince you that you dreamed her up, just as we've been telling you all along and you've refused to believe? Don't you think that the ribbon is just a little too convenient?
Richard frowned at her. What are you getting at?
I don't believe that's what's really going on with you. I think you're wrong about your memories, but I don't believe that the Richard I know could be convinced by the dubious evidence in that grave. This isn't even because Zed doesn't believe your memories any more than Kara and I do.
Then what's it about?
This is all because you believed a corpse in a coffin was her, because you were afraid it was true after your grandfather said that he was disappointed in you and that you let him down.
Richard started to turn away, but Nicky seized his shirt and pulled him back, forcing him to face her.
That's what I think this is about, she said with fierce resolve. You're sulking because your grandfather said you were wrong, said that you disappointed him.
Maybe because I did.
So what?
Richard's face screwed up in confusion.
What do you mean, so what? I mean, so what if he's disappointed in you? So what if he thinks you did a stupid thing? You're your own man. You did what you reasoned you had to do. You acted because you thought you had to act and do the things you did.
But I...
You what? You disappointed him? You made him angry at what you decided to do? He thought more of you, and you let him down? You came up short in his eyes?
Richard swallowed, not wanting to admit it aloud. Nicky lifted his chin and made him look into her eyes.
Richard, you have no responsibility to live up to anyone else's expectations.
He blinked at her, looking speechless.
It's your life, she insisted. You're the one who taught me that. You did what you thought you must. Did you turn down Shota's offer because Kara disagreed with you?
No.
Would you have turned down Shota's offer if you knew I thought you were wrong to give her your sword?
Or would you have turned her down if both of us told you that you'd be a fool to accept?
No, I don't think so. And why not?
because you were doing what you thought you must do, and as much as you would hope we would agree with you, in the end it didn't matter what we thought. Your conviction was what you had to act upon. You didn't quail at the decision. You acted. You did what you felt you had to do. You were making the decision based on what you believe for reasons only you can truly know, and that it was the right thing to do. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes.
Then what difference should it make if your grandfather thinks you're wrong? Was he there? Does he know everything you knew at the time? It would be nice if he believed in what you did, if he supported you and said, "Good for you, Richard," but he didn't. Does that suddenly make your decision wrong, does it?
No.
Then you can't let it take over your mind. Sometimes the people who love us most have the highest expectations for us, and sometimes those expectations are idealized. You did what you had to do, given what you believed and what you know, to find the answers you needed to solve the problem. If everyone else in the world thinks you're wrong, but you believe you're right, you have to act on what you have sound reason to believe. Numbers of those against you don't change the facts, and you must act to find the facts, not satisfy the crowd or any particular individual. You have no responsibility to live up to anyone else's expectations. You have only to live up to your own expectations. Some of the light, the fire, was back in his intent gray eyes.
Does this mean that you believe me, Nikki?
She sadly shook her head. No, Richard, I think your belief in Kaylin is a result of your injury. I think you dreamed her up.
And the grave?
The truth?
When he nodded, Nikki took a deep breath.
I think that is the real mother confessor, Kaylin Amnell.
I see.
Nikki seized his jaw again and made him look back at her. But that doesn't mean that I'm right. I'm basing my belief on other things, things I know. But I don't think that anything I saw in that coffin, as much as I believe it's her, really proves it. I've been wrong in my life before. You've thought I'm wrong all along in this. Are you going to do as someone says who you think is wrong? Why would you do that?
But it's so hard when no one believes me.
Sure it is, but so what? That doesn't make them right, and you wrong.
But when everyone says you're wrong, it starts to make you have doubts.
Yes, sometimes life is really hard. In the past, doubts have always made you dig all the harder for the truth. To be sure you were right, because knowing the truth can give you the strength to fight on. This time, your shock at seeing a body in the mother confessor's grave when you hadn't anticipated even the possibility of one being there, coupled with your grandfather's unexpectedly harsh comments right in that moment of horror, overwhelmed you. I can understand how it was the last straw, and you couldn't fight it anymore. Everyone can sometimes reach the limits of their endurance and give up, even you, Richard Rawl. You are mortal, and you have your limits just like everyone else does. But you have to deal with that and move on. You've had time to temporarily give up, but now you have to take control of your own life again. She could see him thinking, considering. It was a thrilling sight to see Richard's mind back and working. She could still see, though, his hesitation. She didn't want him to come this far and slip back now. People must have not believed you before in other things, she said. Weren't there ever times when this Kaylin of yours didn't believe you? A real person would have sometimes disagreed with you, doubted you, argued with you. And when that happened, you must have done as you thought you had to, even though she thought you were wrong. Maybe even a little crazy. I mean, come on, Richard, this isn't the first time I've thought you were crazy. Richard smiled briefly before thinking it over. Then, a broad grin spread on his face.
Yes, there certainly were times like that with Kaylin, when she didn't believe me.
And you still did as you believed you had to, didn't you?
Richard, still smiling, nodded.
Then don't let this incident with your grandfather ruin your life.
He lifted an arm and let it flop back down.
but it's just that you gave up because of what Zed told you without even using what you got from Shota.
He looked up sharply, his attention suddenly riveted on her. What do you mean?
In exchange for the Sword of Truth, Shota gave you information to help you find the truth. One of the things she told you was, what you seek is long buried. But that's not all. Kara told Zed and me everything Shota said. Apparently the most vital thing she gave you, because it was the first and almost all she thought she had to tell you, was the word chainfire, right?
Richard nodded as he listened.
She then told you that you must find the place of the bones in the deep nothing. Shota also told you to beware of the viper with four heads. What is chainfire? What is the deep nothing? What is the viper with four heads? You paid a dear price for that information, Richard. What have you done with it? You came here and asked Zed if he knew, and he said no. Then he told you that he was disappointed in you. So what? Are you going to throw away everything you've gained in your search just because of that? Because an old man who has no idea what Kalin means to you, or what you've been through the last couple of years, thinks that you acted foolishly? Do you want to move in here and be his lapdog? Do you want to stop thinking and just depend on him to do your thinking for you?
Of course not.
At the grave, Zed was angry. He went through things we probably can't imagine to get the Sword of Truth away from Shota. What would you expect him to say? Oh, yes, that's a good idea, Richard. Just give it back to her. That's fine. He had a lot invested in getting that sword back from her, and he thought you made a foolish trade. So what? That's his view. Maybe he's even right. But you thought it was important enough to sacrifice something he had entrusted to you alone. Something very precious to you. In order to gain a higher value. You believed that it was a fair trade. Kara said that at first you even thought Shota might be cheating you. But then you came to believe that she had given you a fair value. Did Kara tell it true?
Richard nodded.
What did Shota tell you about your bargain?
Richard gazed up at the soaring towers behind Nikki as he recalled the words. Shota said, you wanted what I know that can help you find the truth. I have given it to you, chainfire. Whether or not you realize it right now, I have given you a fair trade. I have given you the answers you needed. You are the seeker, or at least you were. You will have to seek the meaning to be found in those answers.
And you believe her?
Richard considered a moment, his gaze dropping away.
I do.
When he looked back up into her eyes, the spark of life was again blazing there.
I do believe her.
Then you should tell me and Kara and your grandfather that if none of us are going to help you, then we ought to get out of your way and let you do as you must.
He smiled, if somewhat sadly.
You're a pretty remarkable woman, Nikki, to convince me to keep fighting even when you don't believe in what I'm fighting for.
He leaned in and kissed her on the cheek.
I truly wish I could, Richard, for your sake.
I know. Thank you, my friend. And I say friend because only a true friend would be more concerned with helping me face reality than what it means for her.
He reached out and, with his hand cupped to her face, used a thumb to wipe a tear from her cheek.
You have done more for me than you know, Nikki. Thank you.
Nikki felt giddy joy mixed with sinking frustration that they were right back to where they had started. Still, she wanted to throw her arms around him, but instead she simply cupped both her hands over his on the side of her face.
Now, he said, I think we had better go see about Anne and Nathan, and then I need to find out what part Janefire plays in all this. Will you help me?
Nikki smiled as she nodded, too choked up to speak, and then unable to stop herself, at last threw her arms around him and clutched him tightly to her.
Chapter 51. The look on Anne's face as she stepped in the big door and saw Nikki entering the anteroom from between two red pillars was priceless. Nikki would have laughed aloud had her talk with Richard not so emotionally drained her. The prophet, Nikki knew, was very old. but he was by no means feeble-looking. He was tall and broad-shouldered, with distinguished white hair that hung to his shoulders. He looked like a man who could bend iron, and he wouldn't even need his gift to do so. It was the raptor gaze of his dark azure eyes, though, that made him at once intimidating and alluring. They were the eyes of a Rawl. Anne stared, her own eyes wide.
Sister Nikki?
The prelate didn't say, "So good to see you again," or anything cordial. She seemed momentarily unable to think of what to say. Nikki found it just a little remarkable that this squat woman beside the towering prophet had for so long seemed so big in her eyes. Novices and sisters often went for long periods without even seeing the prelate around the palace of the prophets. Absence, Nikki guessed, added to her mythic stature.
"Prelate, I'm glad to see you well, especially after your unfortunate death and funeral."
Nikki glanced over at Richard as she finished the thought. "I hear that everyone believed you were dead. Amazing how a burial can be so convincing, and yet here you are alive and well, it would appear." Richard's twitch of a smile told her that he caught her meaning. Zed to the side, at the brink of the three steps leading down into the center of the room with a fountain, gave Nikki a curious frown. The meaning hadn't been lost on him either.
"Yes, well, that was unfortunately necessary, child."
Anne's expression darkened.
"What with the Sisters of the Dark having infested the ranks of our Sisters of the Light?"
She glanced briefly at Richard, Kara, and Zed, the edge to her countenance softening.
"It appears by the company you keep, Sister Nikki, that you have come back into the fold. I can't tell you how much it pleases me personally. I can only think that the Creator himself must have had a hand in saving your soul."
Nikki clasped her hands behind her back. "The Creator had nothing to do with it, actually. I guess that while I was forced to spend my life serving everyone who decided they wanted the blood and sweat of my abilities, the Creator was busy. I guess he couldn't be bothered while I was being used by pious men telling me how it was my duty to serve and to submit, and to grovel to them and to kill those who oppose the Creator's ways. I guess that all the times those champions of the Creator were raping me, the Creator didn't catch on to the irony." "No more. Richard helped show me the value of my life to myself. And it is no longer Sister Nikki, either of the light or the dark. Nor is it Death's mistress or the slave queen. It is just Nikki now, if you please. And even if you don't." Anne's expression flashed between incredulity and indignation as her face went red.
"But once you are a sister, you are always a sister. You have done a wonderful thing and renounced the Keeper, so you were again a Sister of the Light. You can't simply decide on your own to forsake your duty to the Creator's. If he has any objections, then let him speak up right now."
As the echo of Nikki's heated words faded away, the room fell silent but for the splash of water in the fountain. She made a show of looking around, as if she thought that maybe the Creator might be hiding behind a pillar ready to pop out and make his wishes known.
"No."
She again clasped her hands. She put back on the defiant smile.
"Well then, since he has no objections, Nikki it is, I guess. I'll not have..."
"Anne, enough,"
Nathan said in a deep, commanding voice.
"We have important business, and this isn't it. We didn't travel all this way simply for a dead prelate to lecture a reformed Sister of the Dark."
Nikki was somewhat surprised to hear the voice of reason coming from the prophet. She allowed that perhaps she had put too much stock into idle gossip. Anne's mouth twisted in resignation as she fingered a stray lock of hair into the loose bun at the back of her head.
"I suppose you're right. I'm afraid that I'm a little out of sorts, my dear. What with all the trouble going on? Please forgive my rash presumption, will you, Nikki?"
Nikki bowed her head. "Happily, prelate." Anne smiled, more genuinely, Nikki thought.
"And it's just Anne now. Verna is prelate now. I'm dead, remember?"
Nikki smiled. So you are, Anne. Wise choice, Verna. Sister Cecilia always said that there was no hope of converting that one to the keeper. Some day, when we have the luxury of time, I would appreciate hearing more about Sister Cecilia in addition to Richard's former teachers. She sighed at the thought. I never knew for sure that you and all five of the others were sisters of the dark. Nikki nodded. I'd be happy to tell you what I know about them, the ones still alive anyway. Liliana and Marissa are dead. Tom, how is my sister? Richard asked as soon as there was a brief break in the conversation. Nikki recognized that he had listened long enough and was signaling that he wanted to move on to more important matters.
She is well, Lord Rawl, the big blonde-headed man near the door said.
Good. Nathan, what's going on? Richard anxiously asked, getting right to the point. What trouble are you here about?
Well, among other things, prophecy trouble.
Richard visibly relaxed. Oh, well, that's not something I can help you with.
I wouldn't be so sure, Nathan said cryptically.
Zed stepped off the gold and red carpet and down into the room.
Let me guess. You're here about the blank places in the books of prophecy?
Nikki had to run Zed's words through her mind a second time before she was sure she'd heard him right.
Nathan nodded. You've just sat down in the middle of the muck.
What do you mean you're here about blank places in the books of prophecy? Richard looked suddenly suspicious.
What blank places? Extensive sections of prophecy, that is, prophecy written down in the books of prophecy, have simply vanished off the pages of a number of the books we've so far inspected.
Nathan's brow bunched in an expression of apprehension.
We've checked with Verna, and she confirmed that the books of prophecy at the People's Palace in Dahara are suffering the same inexplicable problem. Therein lies the heart of our worry. We came in part to see if the works of prophecy here at the keep are still intact.
I'm afraid not, Zed said. The books here have been similarly corrupted.
Nathan swiped a hand across his tired face.
Dear spirits, he murmured, we had been holding out hope that whatever is causing such havoc among the prophecies had not affected the books here as well.
You mean that entire sections of prophecy are missing? Richard asked, stepping down into the heart of the room.
That's right, Nathan confirmed.
Would there happen to be a pattern to the missing prophecy? Richard asked, suddenly focusing on a line of reasoning that Nikki knew would end up being somehow related to his own search. Ordinarily, she would have been frustrated or even annoyed that he could think of nothing else but his fixation with the missing woman. But this time, she was heartened to see that the familiar Richard was back.
Why, yes, there is a pattern. They are all prophecies having to do with events beginning roughly around the time of your birth.
Richard stared, dumbfounded. What are the missing prophecies about, specifically? I mean, are they related to specific events, or are they non-specific and instead share only a time period? Nathan stroked his chin as he considered the question.
That's the thing that makes this so strange. Many of the prophecies that are missing we know we should be able to recall. But they are suddenly and completely just as blank in our minds as they are on the page. We can't remember a single word of them. We don't recall what they were about, and since they're gone from the books as well, I can't tell you if they were event-related or time-related or something else. We realize that they are missing, but that's about all.
Richard's eyes turned to Nikki, as if to ask if she caught the correlation. She thought he could see that she did. His voice remained casual, but Nikki knew how intent was the interest behind his words. Pretty odd that something you've known all of your lives can vanish right out of your memory, wouldn't you say?
I certainly would, Nathan said. Any thoughts on the subject, Zed?
Zed, who had been silently and intently watching Richard, nodded.
Well, I know what's causing it. If that will help you out.
He smiled innocently. Nikki noticed that Rika, standing in the shadows, back behind the red pillars, smiled as well. Nathan, at first stunned, became animated with curiosity. Richard gently tugged Zed's robes at his shoulder.
You know?
You do?
Nathan asked, urging Richard back out of the way as he stepped closer. Anne rushed forward with him.
What is it? What's happening? Tell us. A prophecy worm, I'm afraid.
Nathan and Anne blinked, their faces blank of any comprehension.
A what?
Nathan finally ventured, somewhat cautiously, if not suspiciously.
The text vanishing is caused by a prophecy worm. Once a fork of prophecy is infected with this scourge, it worms its way entirely through that branch, consuming it as it goes. Since it consumes the actual prophecy itself, that means that over time, all manifestations of it, such as the written prophecy or any memory of it, are destroyed. It's quite virulent.
Zed regarded their rapt stares with another polite smile.
If you want, I can show you the reference work.
I should say so, Nathan said.
Zed, this is important, Richard said. Why haven't you said something? Zed gave him a familiar clap on the shoulder as he started away.
Well, my boy, when you arrived, you weren't much in the mood to listen to anything but what you were here about. Remember, you were rather insistent that you had trouble and you needed to talk to me about it. Since then, you haven't exactly been willing to talk. You've been rather, distracted.
I guess I was. Richard caught his grandfather's arm, halting him before he could get far. Zed, look, I need to tell you something about all of that and about that night.
Like what, my boy?
I know that a contradiction cannot exist.
I never really thought you did, Richard.
But there was more to it that night. The rule most involved down there at the gravesite was not the one you quoted. It may have seemed that way to you at the moment, but the rule I made a mistake about was another, the one that says in part that people can be made to believe a lie because they fear that it's true. That's what I was doing. I wasn't believing a contradiction. I was believing a lie because I was so afraid it was true. The rule of non-contradiction is one of the ways I should have checked my assumptions. I didn't, and in that, I made a mistake. I understand what it must have looked like to you since you weren't aware of everything that's been happening, but that doesn't mean I should have stopped looking for the truth out of a misplaced wish to make you happy, or out of fear of what you would think of me. He met Nikki's gaze for a brief moment. Nikki helped me see what I was doing wrong. He looked back at his grandfather. I think you meant to show me that the rule you quoted is more, though. It also means you can't hold contradictory values or goals. You can't say, for instance, that honesty is a meaningful value and at the same time lie to people. You can't say that justice is your goal but refuse to hold the guilty responsible for their actions. At the heart of our struggle, the fact that contradictions can't exist is why the Imperial Order's regime is so ruinous. They hold up altruism as their highest purpose. Yet out of their proclaimed selfless concern for one individual, they sacrifice another, soothing over the bloodletting by proclaiming that such a sacrifice is the moral duty of the sacrificial victim. It's nothing more than organized looting, a passion for the happiness of thieves and murderers without any concern for their victim. Attempts at goals that depend on such contradiction can only lead to widespread suffering and death. It's the fraudulent advocacy of the right to life by embracing death as a means to achieve it. The rule you quoted means I can't, like Jagang's followers, say I want the truth and then, without checking my assumption, willingly believe a lie in its stead, even if out of fear. That's the way I violated the rule you quoted. I should have sorted out what looked like contradictions and found the truth staring me in the face. That's where I let myself down.
Are you saying that you now don't believe that was Kaelin Amnell?
Zed asked. Who says that corpse has to be the woman you think it is? There were no facts there to contradict my belief that it wasn't her. I only believed there were out of fear that it was true. It wasn't. Zed took a deep breath, letting it out slowly.
You're stretching things mighty thin, Richard.
Am I? You wouldn't be too pleased with my rationale if I said that there is no such thing as prophecy, and held up the blank books as proof that your belief in the existence of prophecy is wrong. For you to believe that prophecy exists in the face of the fact that the supposed books of prophecy are blank is not a contradiction. It is a perplexing situation with insufficient information to, as of yet, explain the facts. You have no obligation to reach a conclusion or hold an opinion you don't accept for other reasons without adequate information, or before you have finished investigating. What kind of seeker would I be if I did that? After all, it's the mind of the man that makes him the seeker, not the sword. The sword is merely a tool. You're the one who told me that. In the case of Kalin, there are still too many unanswered questions for me to be convinced that what we saw that rainy night is really the truth. Until it's proved one way or another, I'm going to continue to look for the answers, for the truth, because I believe that what is going on is far more dangerous than anyone but me realizes, to say nothing of needing to find a person I love who needs my help. Zed smiled in a grandfatherly way.
Fair enough, Richard, fair enough. But I expect you to prove it to me. I won't take your word for it.
Richard gave his grandfather a firm nod. For starters, I think you have to admit it's rather suspicious that prophecies revolving around Kalin's and my lives are missing. The memory of her is gone. Now the prophecies are gone. That would have to contain reference to her. In both cases, everyone's memory of both real entities, the person and the prophecies referring to that real person, have been wiped away. Do you see what I'm getting at? Nikki was immeasurably relieved to see that Richard was thinking rationally again. She was also concerned that, in a strange way, what he said actually did make some sense.
Yes, my boy, I do see your point. But do you see that there is a problem with your theory?
What's that?
We all remember you now, don't we? And the prophecies about you are missing. As it turns out, in this case, the problem with prophecy doesn't have anything at all to do with what you are hoping will explain or prove the existence of Kalin Amnell.
Why not? Richard asked.
Zed started up the steps.
It has to do with the nature of what I found out when I did my own investigation of the problem with the books of prophecy. I'm not without my own sense of curiosity, you know.
I know that, Zed. But it could be connected, Richard insisted as he walked along beside his grandfather. Nikki hurried after him. Everyone else was forced to fall in behind.
It might seem that way to you, my boy, but your speculation is flawed, because all the facts just don't fit your conclusion. You're trying to wear boots that look good, but are too small.
Zed clapped Richard on the shoulder.
When we get to the library, I'll show you what I mean.
Who's Kalin? Nathan asked.
Someone who vanished and I haven't found yet, Richard said over his shoulder. But I will. Richard paused and turned back to Anne and Nathan. Do either of you know what chain fire is? They both shook their heads. How about a viper with four heads or the deep nothing?
I'm afraid not, Richard, Anne said. But as long as we're on the subject of important matters, we do have other things we need to speak with you about.
After we see Zed's reference about prophecy, Nathan said.
Well, come on then,
Zed told them as he started off with a flourish of his simple robes. Chapter 52. In the plush library, Richard stood behind Zed, watching over his grandfather's bony shoulder as he flipped open a thick book bound in tattered tan leather. The room was rather dimly lit by a number of silver reflector lamps on all four sides of five thick mahogany posts standing in a line down the center of the room. They held up the leading edge of a balcony, running the length of the room. Heavy, dark wooden tables with polished tops lined the center of the room, down the line of posts. Wooden chairs were spaced around the outside of the tables. Opulent carpets with elaborately woven patterns felt soft and quiet underfoot. Perpendicular to the long walls on each side were aisles of shelves, packed with books. Above, the balcony held closely spaced shelves filled with yet more volumes. A gray-blue shaft of sunlight slanting in from the single window high up at the very end of the room lit the dust floating in the stuffy air. The freshly lit lamps added an oily smell. The room had a vault-like quiet about it. Kara and Rika stood off by themselves in the darker area beneath the window at the end of the room, arms folded, heads together, talking in low voices. Nikki stood beside Zed along one edge of a table, lit in a glowing rectangle of sunlight, while Anne and Nathan stood impatiently on the opposite side, waiting for Zed's explanation of how prophecy had vanished. Standing there, in the island of light, the rest of the room faded away into gloomy shadows around them.
"This book was compiled, I believe, sometime not long after the Great War had ended," Zed told them as he tapped the open cover near the title Continuum Ratios and Viability Predictions. "The gifted back then had discovered that, for whatever reason, fewer and fewer wizards were being born, and the ones who were being born were not being born with both sides of the gift, as had almost always been the case before. What's more, the ones who were being born with the gift were all being born with only the additive side. Subtractive magic was vanishing."
Anne looked up from under her brow. "It is hardly a novice and a boy wizard standing before you, old man. We know all this. We have spent our lives devoted to this very problem. Get on with it." Zed cleared his throat.
"Yes, well, as you may know, this also meant that there were fewer and fewer prophets being born."
"How remarkably fascinating," Anne mocked. "I, for one, would never have guessed such a thing."
Nathan irritably hushed her.
"Go on, Zed."
Zed pushed back his sleeves, briefly casting a scowl Anne's way.
"They realized that, with ever fewer wizards born to prophecy, the body of work of prophecy was, of course, going to cease to grow. In order to understand what the consequences of this might mean, they decided that they needed to do an intensive investigation of the entire subject of prophecy. While they still could, while they still had prophets and other wizards with both sides of the gift, they approached the problem with the gravest of concern, realizing that with them, this might very well be mankind's last opportunity to comprehend the future of prophecy itself, and to offer future generations an insight to understanding what these wizards were increasingly coming to believe would one day be seriously corrupted or even lost."
Zed glanced up to see if Anne looked like she intended to offer any more disparaging comments. She did not. This was apparently something she hadn't known.
"Now," he said, "to their work."
Richard moved up to the table beside Nikki, and with a finger turned over pages as he listened to Zed. He quickly noticed that the book was written in such strange technical jargon having to do with the intricacies of not only magic, but prophecy as well, that it was nearly incomprehensible to him. It might as well have been a different language. One of the surprises was that the book contained a series of complex mathematical formulas. These were interrupted by diagrams of the moon and stars marked with angles of declination. Richard had never before seen a book about magic that contained such equations, celestial observations, and measurements. Not that he had actually seen that many books about magic. Although, he recalled, the Book of Counted Shadows that he had memorized as a boy did have a number of sun and star angles that were necessary to know in order to open the boxes of Orton. Yet more formulas were scratched in the margins, but by different hands, as if someone had come along and done the sums to check the work in the book, or perhaps approached it with updated information. In one instance, several of the numbers in an elaborate table were crossed out, with arrows pointing from new numbers scribbled in the margins to the stricken numbers in the tables. Zed occasionally stopped Richard from turning pages in order to point out an equation and explain the symbols involved in the calculation. Like a dog watching a bone, Nathan's dark azure eyes tracked the pages as Richard slowly turned each over, idly looking for anything that made sense to him as Zed droned on about overlapping transpositional forks and triple duplexes bound to conjugated roots, compromised by precession and sequential proportional binary inversion shrouded flawed bifurcations that the formulas revealed, which could only be detected through subtractive levorotatory. Nathan and Anne stared without blinking. Once, Nathan even gasped. Anne incrementally went ashen. Even Nikki seemed to be listening with uncharacteristic attention. The unfathomable concepts made Richard's head spin. He hated that feeling of drowning in incomprehensible information, of trying to keep his head above the dark waters of complete confusion. It made him feel dumb. Intermittently, Zed referred to numbers and equations from the book. Nathan and Anne acted like they thought Zed was on the verge of revealing not only how the world was going to end, but the precise hour. "Zed?" Richard finally asked, interrupting his grandfather in the middle of a sentence that showed no signs of ever coming to an end. "Is there any way you can boil this stew down to some meat that I can chew?" Mouth agape, Zed regarded Richard for a moment before pushing the book across the table to Nathan.
"I'll let you read it for yourself."
Nathan cautiously picked up the book, as if the keeper himself might pop out at him. Zed turned back to Richard.
"Basically, to put it in terms you might better grasp, and at great risk of oversimplifying it, imagine that prophecy is like a tree, with roots and branches. Like a tree, prophecy was continually growing. What these wizards were basically saying was that the tree of prophecy behaved as if there were a kind of life to it. They weren't saying that it was alive, mind you, only that in a number of ways it mimicked, not duplicated, some attributes of a living organism. It was this property that allowed them to come up with their theory and from that run their calculations. In much the way there are parameters by which you can judge the age and health of a tree and from that extrapolate about its future. During a previous time, when there had been a great many prophets and wizards around, the works of prophecy and its many branches grew quite rapidly. With all the prophets who had contributed, it had solid, fertile ground in which to grow and deep roots. With new prophets constantly bringing new vision to the collected works, new forks of prophecy sprouted continuously, and those new branches, over time as other prophets added to them, grew thick and strong. As it grew, prophets continually examined, observed, and interpreted events, enabling them to tend the living stock and prune the deadwood. But then, the birth rate of prophets began to plummet, and with each passing year there were fewer and fewer of them to attend to such duties. Because of this, the growth of the tree of prophecy began to slow. In essence, to explain it in simple terms you can understand, the tree of prophecy had in a way matured. Like an old monarch oak in a forest, these wizards knew that the vast tree of prophecy had many years of life ahead of it as a mature entity. But they also knew what the future eventually held in store. Like all things, the existence of prophecy could not be eternal. As time passed, prophetic events came to pass, becoming outdated. These no longer served any use. In this fashion, if nothing else, the passage of time would eventually supersede all the predictions dealt with in the work. In other words, without new prophecy, all the existing prophecy, whether or not they turned out to be true forks, nonetheless would eventually reach their chance in the chronological flux. As they did, their time passed. They would be used up. Thus the commission studying the problem came to realize that the tree of prophecy, without the growth and life that it drew from prophets, from the constant stream of prophecy feeding the many branches, would eventually die. Their task and the purpose of this book, Continuum Ratios and Viability Predictions, was to try to predict how and when this would happen. The best minds in prophecy study the problem, took a measure of the health of the tree of prophecy. Through known formulas and predictions based on not only observed patterns in the decline of growth in prophecy, but a decline in profits to sustain it, they determined how this particular tree of knowledge would become heavy with the deadwood of false and expired prophecy as prophetic forks were reached and chronology moved on down the sections of branches still viable. As this happened, as the tree of prophecy grew thick with age and deadwood that could no longer be culled by true prophets, they predicted how it would become susceptible to a kind of malady, a decay, much like an old tree in the forest will eventually become susceptible to disease. That decline in viability they found would over time leave prophecy vulnerable to any number of ever-growing problems. The infirmity that they concluded would be the most likely to strike first would come in a form they described as worm-like. They thought that it would begin to infest and destroy the living portions of the tree of prophecy itself, meaning the branches that are contemporary at the time of this worm-like infestation. In fact, they called it just that, a prophecy worm.
The air felt heavy in the thick silence. Hands in his back pockets, Richard shrugged.
So, what's the cure?
Astonished by the question, Zed stared at Richard as if he just asked how to heal a thunderstorm.
Cure? Richard, these experts who wrote this book predicted that there wasn't any cure as such. They concluded in the end that without the vitality provided by new prophets, the tree of prophecy would eventually rot and die. They said that prophecy would only come back strong and healthy when new prophets returned to the world. In effect, when a seed of new prophecy sprouted and flourished, old trees die and make room for the new shoots. It was determined by these learned wizards that the fate of prophecy as we know it is also doomed to aging, infirmity, and eventual death.
Richard had had to deal with any number of problems caused by prophecy, but the gloomy expressions around the table were infectious. It almost felt like a healer had come out of a back room to announce that an aging relative was near to passing on. He thought about all the gifted prophets devoted to their calling, who had worked all of their lives to contribute to this great body of work that was now withering and dying.
This is the end of disc number 17. Please insert disc number 18.